pray. I don't know if anybody else does, but I want to be saved. All right. I screwed up something important. In my haste to get this large-scale proposal out yesterday, I neglected to send out email to people reminding them that they should actually bring the printouts to class. Uh-oh. So I'm about to try to walk through some source code, which you may not have with you. If you have a laptop with you, you can sing along and get the lyrics from. dev.aerosos.com/hg for Mercurial. I mean, somebody said to you you were going to use Mercurial. Wouldn't HG be the first command name you would type? Okay. All right. We power on the machine. And the hardware self-initializes, which is a state that is useful to you and me only in the sense that we can then finish the job. The Pentium processor, the power of advertising is amazing, right? The Pentium processor is defined to power up in a state, you know, where actually the name of the processor is in the registers after power up. Could somebody pull the door?
Yeah.
So shortly after power up, you know, the processor comes up, right? It pats itself on the back and the stomach. In my case, there's a lot of stomach to pat. And it says, yeah, I'm all here. What should I do? I have no idea. So basically what it does is it jumps to a well-defined address. Well-defined means if you search hard enough, you'll find it printed in the manual. And it runs the instruction there. What instruction is that? I don't know. Who built your ROM? Okay, it's an instruction in the BIOS ROM. And remember we talked about the physical address map. If you actually look at the processor, you'll discover that it branches to an address that is very high up in the 32-bit physical address space. High enough up that it can't possibly be in the ROM, because after all, the ROM is below 1 megabyte. The address in question is very close to 4 gigabytes. You know, the beauty about compatibility requirements is the marketing people can jerk your chain on them pretty much forever. Backwards compatibility is so powerful in the PC world that there are hardware fixes. And one of them is something called the A20 gate. What is A20? A20 is the address pin that carries bit 20 of the address, starting from 0. Why is bit 20 magical? Okay, you've all memorized your powers of 2 by now. So 2 to the 20 is a lot. Yeah, that's 1 megabyte. So if I were to actually, of course we're going to number from 0, right? So 1 megabyte means 1 megabyte less 1. If I were to actually assert the address 1 megabyte on the bus, that would be the first address that would cause the 20th address line to have a non-zero signal line. A20 gate is a compatibility hack, in the sense of wheeze and cough, that masks all bits above address line 20 off of the bus. They never make it to the memory system. And the effect of this is that going to address 1 megabyte and 1 is exactly the same as going to address 1 when the machine powers up. The idea is we want to look as much like a DOS machine as possible. This, of course, is what you wanted to buy when you went down and spent your $650 and falling on your desktop PC, right? CompUSA, those few that remain are basically no longer selling desktop PCs. There's no margin in them. There's also no margin in laptop PCs, so in the future you'll be buying from Dell or somebody else. So that ROM, that high-order memory address actually basically gets collapsed down to fall into the ROM. And the initial hardware configuration, like I've told you, has that ROM appearing at multiple locations in case you lose it. Now, the A20 gate is something that you can disable so that you can access the rest of your memory. I personally have not bought a 1 megabyte PC in several years. Well, not even by accident, now that I think about it. I mean, my microwave has more than a megabyte of memory these days. So where do you suppose, what you know, there are dozens of subsystems on a processor. So on the PC XT and later, what part of the machine would you imagine that you would talk to get the A20 gate turned off? How many things somewhere in the memory system? Okay, good. We've established that you're not complete suckers. Would you believe the keyboard controller? I mean, perfectly obvious, right? You want more memory, talk to the keyboard, right? The reason is the keyboard controller had a spare pin when this hack went into the machine. Nowadays, both the hack and the keyboard controller are in a common ASIC, so the pin isn't really the big deal. But, you know, why change a good thing? Okay. So the machine comes up in this 1 megabyte state, okay? And at this point it says, okay, the BIOS says, okay, let me figure out how much memory I have. And it pokes your memory and thumps you and, you know, puts the tongue depressor down your mouth and sees if you have a disease in the back of your throat, you know, checks your vision, looks for the wax in your ears, and says, great, I'm a PC. At which point it says, well, do I have a floppy drive? How many of you have seen a floppy drive? Okay. How many of you noticed you can almost not purchase a machine now that has a floppy drive? You have to get a USB floppy now if you want a floppy for those old memories. Pokes the floppy drive, says, is there a floppy in the drive? If so, it loads, count them, 512 bytes from the front end of the floppy, and puts them in a well-known address and jumps there. Unless you call it back, that's the end of the BIOS, folks. Now the floppy drive thumps your hardware system and says, do you have a hard drive? Nowadays, it'll thump the USB system, it'll thump the CD-ROM, it'll thump your mother. If it loads 512 bytes from your mother, that's also the end of the BIOS. What those bytes mean, talk to your mom. Okay, it gets 512 bytes from somewhere, and it transfers control of those 512 bytes with registers set to almost but not quite tell you where you came from. In fact, if it booted from a USB device, it will have created a DOS entry simulating a disk drive so that you can do further I/O. Because even in assembly language, 512 bytes isn't that big. And that's, of course, ignoring the fact that the leading like 50 or 60 of those bytes are occupied by a table that says things like, what's the format of the floppy drive? Oh, I did mention you don't know what the format of floppy drive is, right? So there's this bootstrapping exercise that's like a wart on a hair on the ass of an elephant, and on and on, being transported by a, you know, C-31 cargo carrier, you know, on its way to, I don't know. So 512 bytes says, you know, generally speaking, 512 bytes is not quite enough to pick my nose in x86 assembly language. So, I need more code. I know. Let me fetch the next few sectors. That's that 512 byte unit that we just loaded off the disk drive. This, by the way, would have been a relatively late model floppy drive because earlier floppy drives used 256 byte sectors. All of this mainly for the purpose of running a hopefully short assembly language sequence whose job is to go out and thump and prod your machine and re-execute a lot of the work that the BIOS did on the assumption, sadly generally correct, that the BIOS did it wrong. BIOS, by the way, has set up your PCI bus. It's arranged for at least some of the interrupts because these days your disk drive is on the other end of that PCI bus. Generally speaking, it's actually arranged those interrupts incorrectly because it obeyed a table that was written by your PC vendor in a standard language that, having assembled the hardware and actually knowing where everything goes, your PC vendor can't actually describe the number of BIOSes that have shipped with bugs in their ACPI tables, which is what's used for all of this, is astounding. Go read the Linux code, the blacklist for this stuff. The number of machines where the operating systems come up and says, aha, I know this one. No. The table, I'm just going to ignore it. I have the right one over here. There actually are some that are usably correct. The answer is, I don't know. I only know that the blacklist is impressive. The BIOS and your early code have a relatively simple time in life because they're only doing one thing at a time, so they don't run into hardware bugs very often. My personal favorite, there was a generation of Intel chipset that one of its prominent features was the chipset supported two IDE buses, unless you tried to use them at the same time. If an interrupt came in on one bus while data was being transferred on the other bus, the results were speculative. You got to speculate. Since the BIOS only does one thing at a time, it doesn't tend to hit issues like that. But the upshot of it is that the thing that gets loaded, in our case, is something called GRUB. GRUB stands for Grand Unified Bootloader. It's probably no worse than the things that preceded it. And GRUB mostly goes around and thumps and prods your disk drive and figures out where it's going to load the next piece of junk from. GRUB also negates this A20 gate. And by the time the operating system gets control, you're operating in 32-bit physical address mode on a Pentium. Different hardware will go about this in different ways. The basic idea is you go through multiple stages of mostly useless crap before you run the first instruction you care about. And many stages of that useless crap do the same things over and over again because, of course, the previous stage of useless crap was really useless. You may have noticed that every programmer in a systems sort of context believes that all preceding programmers are useless. And the sad part is how often that's correct. And to be fair, it doesn't take a lot of machines with a bug that impacts Bootstrap to carry a legacy issue for a long time. BIOS call you can make that says, how much memory do I have? The overwhelming majority of BIOSes actually implement that call correctly. There was a Gateway 386 machine that didn't. I was still prepared to repair the answer. There are still people in some countries running those machines. Complaints we see on the Coyotes mailing list, please don't drop support for the 486. They're slow, but they're doing useful work for us. You can't buy a 486 now. You haven't been able to buy a 486 for almost a decade. That's why Pentiums do not run the space shuttle. You can't get replacement parts. Otis designs elevators, right? They put multiprocessor systems on top of the elevators. Historically, they built a system that had five processors that were set up in kind of a voting and cross-checking mode. Why? Because the elevator has a 25-year design lifespan, and two or three of those processors will have failed. By the time they fail, they can't be replaced because you can't buy anymore. If you can get the same architecture, it won't be in the same package. So, you know, legacies, the nice thing about them is they last forever. If you want to make yourself, you know, sort of historically important, insert a bug into a BIOS somewhere. I'm kidding. There are much better ways to do it. Rob a bank, it's more fun. Okay. So by the time kernel gets control, a bunch of things have happened. GRUB has gone, it's turned off the A20 lines, so we're now running in physical 4 gigabyte mode. It's figured out what this drive to boot from. It's loaded a bunch of stuff. And for our purposes, the stuff that it's loaded that we care about is loaded two binaries. One of them, surprise, is called Coyotes. That one would be the kernel. And the other one, the name doesn't matter. It's actually in the GRUB bootstrap script. You can change bootstrap. That was not done on purpose, but it does seem to fit. You can change the names of both of these things. Basically, it's booting a DOS image, DOS floppy image at the moment. And typically, the name of the second file will be makeimage.out. Why? Well, if you don't tell it otherwise, that's the name that you will get out of makeimage. And most of the test cases just do the simple thing, and so they just don't fight City Hall. What are these two files? Well, Coyotes is the kernel binary image. And it's going to get loaded at 1 megabyte. Why 1 megabyte? Because some of those people in South America actually still are running 486s, and so they still care about the 640K limit in the legacy DMA chip. So we really don't want to put stuff down there that we can avoid. Or at least that was the story in 1994, and nobody's bothered to change the address since then. What about the other file? I have no idea where the other file goes. There's someplace that Grubb chose to put it. High likelihood, Grubb, having great respect for people in South America, went into low memory where it can maximize its ability to get in the way of everything. It's not a policy decision on the part of Grubb, it's just a certain amount of laziness on the part of the implementers. Actually, it turns out that's a fine place to put it because we're going to copy it anyway. We're going to copy it, and in order to get out of the way, we're going to copy it into high memory, so the last place we want it sitting is high memory. We'd have to copy it out of the way so that we could copy it out of the way. Problem. We don't know where it went. Grubb will tell us, because Grubb builds up a bunch of data structures. It also asks the BIOS for information about your video subsystem, the phase of the moon, your mother's maiden name, that so that they can call your bank, other things like that. But in particular, it loads these files and it builds up a list of what files it loaded and where it put them. It has no idea what's in most of these files. So if you go and look at the Grubb specification, those of you who are browsing, if you go down into the SysArch i386 test directory, you'll see a Grubb disk. That's a 1.44 megabyte file that's actually a floppy image, and you can loop that mount it, which is something I guess I'll send out mail saying how to do. And it basically says, well, okay, this is the kernel we're going to boot, Coyotes, and this is this module thing, and I don't know what it's for. That's the kernel's job. My job is just to get it in memory. Having done that, Grubb branches into the kernel. It jumps, right? Where? Well, there's a little header in the file that says where it should go, and that's it. We're done with Grubb. And like so many pieces of the PC, we're not going to look back. Grubb is much better than what came before it, but nothing's perfect. At the time that we enter the kernel, we're in a rather precarious state. Grubb has arranged for us to be in a 4 gigabyte physically addressed world. Actually, there's no contract that says physically addressed. One possibility is that Grubb has set up a flat virtual map somewhere that maps 0 to 0, 1 to 1, and so forth. We don't know. Grubb has put the processor in protected mode because without being in protected mode, you can't be in a 4 gigabyte space. So the problem here is that we're running out of some data. And Grubb has loaded the segment registers of the machine with known values. And if you don't know what segment registers are, you'll be pleased to learn that I'm not going to tell you. Except to say that they exist, that we have to load them with values that will make them get the hell out of our way, that Grubb has helpfully done that, but the hardware will complain if we then take the tables away from which these values came. So Grubb has created some tables from which it loaded these values. Unfortunately, we don't know where those tables are. Grubb won't tell us. That didn't occur to Eric when he worked on Grubb. So we're in this very awkward state that there's some stuff that Grubb has handed us that we really kind of need to move around, but we don't dare move it until we figure out where those brown steaming piles are that we had best not put our boots in. Right? Those are the ones Grubb won't tell us about. Maybe that's why it's called Grubb. I don't know. Okay. Back to posteriority jokes, aren't I? So, before we can do that, we have to find out what processor we're on. And the reason we have to find out what processor we're on is that we really want to set up a virtual map for the kernel. But depending on what processor we're running on, we want to either set it up as a legacy virtual map or, if possible, as a new generation virtual map. And if we're actually on a 486, the new generation is an option. And if we're on certain particular steppings of the Pentium Pro, the new generation requires treading carefully. Good point. So there's a little bit of thumping and prodding that we have to do on the way up before we can get out of this mess. And I have to say that barring a couple of three-line procedures that we're going to see elsewhere that exist mostly because they're the only way you can set certain dedicated hardware registers, this boot.s file is roughly the last piece of assembly language we're going to look at. The best thing about assembly language is that you can stop using it. You have to use it initially. So, okay. How many of you have done enough programming in C to know what the BSS area is? Or better still, how many people don't? If I, in a C file, int I semicolon at global scope, what's the, by the way, anybody know why, if it's an integer, I'll always write I and then J and then K? Yeah?
Doesn't it have to do with, like, how
Fortran? Yes, because my grandfather learned to program in Fortran. And Fortran variables starting with I are integer variables by assumption. So, like, IJK are integers, FGH are float. And these conventions live on long after the programming languages that invented them are dead. Fortran, regrettably, has not quite achieved that iterable state, but we're working on it. So if I write int I, anybody know what the value of I is when the program starts? What's that?
Any God-based value.
Any what based value?
Any undefined value.
Any undefined value. Thank you for playing. Reasonable speculation, but not correct. That would be true if it were a local variable in a procedure. It would take on whatever junk happened to be on the stack at that place. But if it's a global variable, the value is actually well-defined. Zero. Why? Well, we also have to thank Fortran for this. Fortran has something called the common area. And in Fortran, if you write that variable in two different files, Fortran is required to unify them. So the common area is all only applies if you don't initialize the variables. And it's backed by zeros, according to the Fortran specification. So that gets carried forward into the linker, which linker was then used to do the original implementation of C. So you end up with this BSS area. BSS is actually the name of an instruction on an early machine. I can never remember what the opcode actually stands for. But the upshot of it is, if you explicitly initialize a variable, including just for your amusement, if you initialize it to zero, you go in the data area, which is short for the initialized data area. If you fail to initialize it at global scope, it will get put in the BSS area. And the purpose of the BSS instruction was to do a block zero. A region of storage. It's actually block something storage. I don't remember what the middle S is. So
block started by storage is Wikipedia.
Oh, okay. What?
Block started by symbol.
Block started by symbol. Okay, so much for my explanation of BSS. Thank you. If you were writing your program to run on a Unix system, the loader, or the dynamic loader, depending on which generation of Unix we're talking about, or the kernel at load time, would gleefully help you out by providing a bunch of zeros at these locations. The nice thing, by the way, about knowing that these locations are supposed to be zeros is we don't have to actually store them in the file. Arbitrarily long sequences of zeros compress very nicely. So the nice thing about BSS is it doesn't actually occupy any space in your file system in the binary image, but somebody has to zero the stuff. Guess what? You're a kernel. Somebody would be us. And first, it's going to turn out we're going to need to save some of the information that multiboot, the grub handed us. Grub uses a handoff standard called multiboot. And of course, guess where we're going to want to put that? We're going to want to put it in a global variable so we can remember where it went later. And we don't really know what value it has, so this global variable is probably uninitialized. And guess what's going to happen when we zero the zero region? Whatever we put there, we're going to clobber. Which leaves us with a chicken and an egg. The chicken is, The multi-boot state is sitting in registers and we need to save it. And the egg is we have to zero memory before we save it, or we will zero memory after we save it. I never thought you'd be doing this when you started that Java course, did you? This is all so simple in Java, right? Because the world does consist of an infinite number of memory cells backed by zeros. So the nice thing about the Pentium is, as long as grub doesn't use more than four or five registers to tell us what's going on, we can just barely get by with the remaining two to zero things. This is what this first little bit of code, starting at about line 130, for those of you who are following along, does. That's the REPSTOSP. The rest is determining where we're going to start and how many bytes we're going to do. Congratulations, we now have initialized the uninitialized data region. Really exciting code, right? I mean, you can tell that when the Unix linker or loader does this, it involves a huge amount of work, right? But the point is, it wasn't your work. In a kernel, nothing comes for free. It's there because you made it happen. So, great. Now we can save the stuff that multi-boot handed us. And the important thing we need to save is it's got a table of information that it's going to pass along to us, and it's going to tell us where that table starts. That's a piece of information we would prefer not to lose, because among the pieces of information that are in that table are how much physical memory there is, how it's broken up, and where it can be found, which is something we would dearly like to know, just not quite yet. All right, I said that we were running at 1 megabyte. I also said last week that, at least on the Pentium, on other architectures, there are other conventions. We're ultimately going to want the kernel to run in the higher part of the virtual address space. Depending on which operating system you're in, fishing on the Pentium family or on the IA32 family has been that the kernel either owns everything starting at 2 gigabytes and up, so the application gets the bottom half, kernel gets the top half. Unix people thought that was rather greedy of the Redmond people, so they went for the top quarter, which means that if I'm the kernel, I really want to be running out of addresses above there, which is how you say 3 gigabytes in a hexadecimal. Because grub didn't put me there, there's a good reason for that. You might not have had 3 gigabytes of physical memory on your machine. Who's the graphics guy? Yeah, so he did, but the rest of us don't. Now there's a problem, right? So because we anticipated that the kernel would run at these very high addresses, we told the linker that when it combined all the pieces of the program to form the kernel binary, that those addresses should start at 3 gigabytes. We ain't there. So in fact, more precisely, because we anticipated the problem we currently have, we told it that the kernel should start at 3 gigabytes plus 1 megabyte. Of course, at least for the moment, is a lot. It's not quite a statistic. It's not that bad, but it's a lot. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And 84% of all statistics are actually made up on the spot. Okay. So there is this problem that if we do something silly like jump to some symbol. Okay, something I should say about assembly for people who've never seen it. If you have a name over on the left, followed by a colon, followed by an instruction, that name is called a label. And the assembler is a very advanced tool. If you say, jump to this label, it's just barely smart enough to understand that that means I want to go to that instruction. The linker will also help you out by saying, oh, and you know, all the labels, everything should start at a certain address, and it will just sort of flow the code, it will pour it out into the binary image, and it will keep track of where the labels went. So if you say jump to that label, it will happily jump to one of those addresses starting at C100,000 hex. Which sounds good, except we ain't there. Well, the problem we have here is we got to get there, because we can't go to C code until we undo this little lie. And we did not really have the option to link the kernel at the lower address. The Arrow system actually did that, and then it used segmentation to flip the lie in the other direction. This is at best non-portable, and it had some awkwardness to it. So the best strategy is going to be to get ourselves a virtual address map built as fast as we can that will get us remapped to where we said we were going to be. Until we do that, We have to be very careful in what instructions we use and what labels we use and how we use them to undo the helpful stuff that the linker did for us.
What is so bad about running the kernel at the bottom of the
Okay. There are two answers. I mean, the simple answer is nothing. From a pragmatic standpoint, what you would like, you sort of like it that the kernel virtual range and the user virtual range were kind of separated, and one had one and one had the other, and it wasn't like there was a hole in the middle of your address space. It really doesn't matter that much if the application sits at the top, except that we might actually want to do backwards compatibility with earlier generations of operating systems. We might want to emulate a Unix environment. In order to emulate a Unix environment, we have to be able to give the low 3 gigabytes of the virtual address space to the application. The nice thing about legacy is you never get to outgrow it. So that's the answer. So you'll see if you look at this that one of the things it does pretty early is it saves the value of it loads the address of this multi-boot signature symbol. What is that? Well, that's something that we declared somewhere in C code as an int. Loads it into this ESI register, mainly because it's then going to subtract this KVA. So what's KVA? KVA is a symbol that's defined using the C preprocessor. One of the things you'll discover is all the assembly code in the Kyotos kernel is run through the C preprocessor before the assembler sees it. What's the value of KVA? Glad you asked. It's C000, it's the BIOS, right? It's the number 3 gigabytes. So the linker has left us in a state where the value of this multi-boot signature symbol is something above 3 gigabytes. When we subtract KVA, we're correcting it to the address that we're actually running at. You may have taken it for granted before that you could do something called position-independent code, that you could compile code that could run at any address. This is how the compiler does it, except we're doing it by hand for the moment. And we're going to get out of this state very quickly. You might imagine that it would be tremendously robust to write a lot of assembly code using this idiom. So we're going to try to get out of this as fast as possible, but we're not done thumping the processor yet to see if it's alive. And there's reason for skepticism about this, given the architecture. So now we've got the multi-boot information saved, so we can come back to it later. We still must not allocate any memory because we don't know where those happy steaming turds are, and we need them steaming later. It's a little dry without the commentary. Come on. Now we need to know what kind of processor we're on, right? Because if we're in South America, we're going to want to change the time zone. We're going to, you know, lots of things like that. No, we're not. But certainly if we're on a 486, we do not want to turn on the PAE addressing mode features, which do not exist on that processor. And we specifically do not want to run on a 386 because there's a missing hardware feature that we really want, which is that the kernel will not honor the non-writable protection bit if you're in supervisor mode. This, you can simulate the correct behavior in software, but it adds so much overhead that it's not worth it. And we decided to abandon the 386 processor. Both of the users who complained were sent apology notes. There were two. We offered to send them 486s. For some reason, they didn't want them. We weren't sure that they worked because we hadn't been able to test them. Okay, so basically, if you're on a 386, how are we going to know? Well, the way you find out if you're on a 386, and now we're into serious arcana. All processors have something called a status word or a flags word, and you'll discover that as processors get revised and new versions come along, they discover more reasons to have bits in the flags word. So the way you find out if you're on a 386 is to determine whether a particular bit is implemented. You do that as you change its value and see if it's stayed changed. However, Pentium is a special processor.
Which
sense? Any way you want to go. The flags word is stored in a register. Depending on which generation of Intel processor you're looking at, it's called flags or eFlags, or I'm sure they renamed it on the 64-bit machines, but I don't really care what.
R-flags.
What?
R-flags.
R-flags, right. Right. Because, you know, with more bits, you need a change of name, right? I mean, it's... it is a register, but it is unlike all other registers. You know, why is this register different from all other registers? The rest of you can ask for an explanation from your classmates who are Jewish. It's different because you can't just load and store from it and you can't copy it to another register. The only way you can talk to the flags register is to put it on the stack. Then look at what turd the processor just pooped out onto the stack. Of course, there's a little problem. Where are we going to put the stack? Because there are those other... Never mind. So... fortunately, we've done a few other operating systems before and we saw this problem coming. So we have a stack already allocated. It's compiled into the kernel image. And this will not be wasted space. We will later use this for the stack for the kernel on the, whatever the first processor is. And we know where that stack went because we compiled it into the image. So we very carefully and delicately load a pointer to the top of that stack at this moment. So that's what's happening with this put kstack high minus kVA in the ESP. The level of abstraction, by the way, in this whole exercise is going to go up shortly. But I want to give you a taste of what it takes to get a machine running. That's part of the point of doing this. So, good. Now we have a stack, and that means we can push the flags register. And if we push the flags register, we can change bits in the value, and then we can pop the flags register. And then we can push them again and see if they stay changed. It's really that bad. Okay. Good. If the bit does not change, then the tree did not fall in the forest, and you're on a 386. At which point, you'll notice that there's a branch to fail prehistoric, or print message prehistoric, and we make a snotty comment about your processor and suggest that it might be time for an upgrade. At that point, we stop. We probably should take that out. Yeah?
Could you go over again why the push...
The minus kVA is dealing with the fact that we told the linker we're in one place and we're in a different place. kVA is actually the delta between these two numbers.
Did you comment
486
earlier?
I did and I lied.
Okay.
486s are hereby declared prehistoric. Actually, what happened was the original version of this code was doing the 386 check, and I looked at it and said, this is really stupid. And I sent out a note to the list saying, how many of you people in South America can live with a Pentium? And everybody said, yeah, okay. So, and by the way, I want to be clear. I actually don't mean to be picking on South America. That was not my intention. And if it's come across that way, that's not what I mean at all. There's every reason to want this thing to run on processors that are executing in places in the world that that are still using older processors. So, I joke a little bit about it, mainly because there's a certain amount of pain with trying to drag back to the front of my memory behavior of processors that I haven't seen in 15 years. But it's not that I mean to belittle anybody. It's that we actually do want to support those processors. Okay, so now, of course, having tweaked the flags, we've got to put them back, for which we push and pop again. Push means stick a register in the stack. Okay. And at this point, we say, okay, now we need to find out if the CPU implements something called the CPU ID instruction. This is an instruction that will actually give us the answers to all the rest of our questions, if it's present. If it is not, then we're also on a processor that we're not going to support. The CPU ID in some form exists on almost everything in the Pentium later. That is the Pentium Zero, the original version. If we have CPU ID, we can now use that to determine whether several other features are present on the processor. The order in which we check exploits knowledge of the evolution of the processor set. So we know, for example, that PAE showed up on the Pentium Pro. We know that, was that right? It might have been Pentium. The fast system call instruction showed up in the middle of the Pentium Pro series. It wasn't stable until the processors in the following generation. So there's a series of checks like that, the end of which is that we're checking for three features. Checking for something called the global bit. I'll explain the global bit now. Here's the idea. We have this thing called the TLB that remembers mappings. Some mappings are the same in all processes, specifically the mappings for the kernel. And if we can avoid chucking those out of the TLB unnecessarily, then we can avoid reloading them. And on older processors, reloading them is only about 40 cycles. On newer processors, it's a little more expensive than that. So we'd actually like to avoid chucking those. The global bit says, when you chuck everything else, this one doesn't have to go. If it's there, eventually we'd like to use it. The current kernel is not doing so. That's PGE. PSE is checking for large pages, which I'm definitely not going to explain, and we're not currently using. And then the other thing primarily, debugging extensions. So later processors have some extra debugging facilities. We want to use them if they're present, so turn them on. They're not turned on by default because of a legacy issue in the hardware. And then the big one is finding out, and this is at the about line 240, whether we have a machine that can do PAE mappings. And if so, we're going to use the newer mapping mechanism. Once we know these things, we know enough to set up an initial set of kernel page tables. There's this problem with storage again. We can't go allocating storage because we're not done with grub yet. So as with the stack, we actually have pre-compiled into the image space for a page table, one page directory, and if we're running in PAE, one vestigial page directory above it. PAE has a third level of this 400s. As I talked about last week, those two tables use different formats of data structure. Depending on whether we're in PAE mode or not, we're going to populate those pages differently because we have to write the appropriate data structure for the mode that we're about to turn on. And let me not burden you with trying to figure out what the heck this assembly code is doing, but basically what it's doing is it's saying, look, we want to define all of the addresses from 3 gigabytes up. 3 gigabytes, that address is going to go to physical page 0. 3 gigabytes plus one page is going to go to physical page 1 and so forth. And we're going to define valid mappings for, in this case, the entire upper gigabyte. We may not have that much physical memory, mind you, but we're going to define valid mappings, at least temporarily. And we're also going to define a set of mappings that goes 0 to 0, 1 to 1, 2 to 2. Okay, so we're doing an alias here, taking the physical memory and we're making it appear at virtual address 0 and also at virtual address 3 gigabytes. Actually, we haven't yet made it appear, but we're setting up the tables that will let us do that. Before I do one. And how are we configuring them? We're saying these pages are writable, are valid. We also actually mark them as accessed and dirty. If we do not mark them as accessed and dirty, the hardware will endeavor to help us. This is some feature that's designed into the hardware to let us know which pages are actually getting used. So the first time a page is actually referenced, if it is not already set, the hardware will set the accessed bit in the page table entry. So not only will it load the page table entry, it will then say, I've got to put that back. And the first time that page is modified, the hardware will similarly put back a bit that says the page is now dirty, meaning modified, as opposed to you should wash your hands. Although, I'm an Intel partner. We don't really use either of these features of the hardware, so rather than have the hardware due time telling us things we don't actually want to know, we lie to it and tell it that, these things have already happened. Whereupon it will not endeavor to write those bits back. And there's a reason for that. Unfortunate things happen on multiprocessors if two processors have the misfortune to attempt to write these bits to the same location at the same time. There are two problems with these unfortunate things. One, they're really unfortunate. And two, they're near as damn it impossible to reproduce, which means you can't debug them. Better to say get out of our way, so that's why we're sending those bits that way. Now, why are we preparing these tables to be at both locations? We're about to turn on the virtual addressing system. At the moment that we turn on the virtual addressing system, we're still attempting to execute instructions at the low address. If we turn on the virtual addressing system without a valid mapping at the low address, guess what's going to happen? We'll get to see that advertising segment for the BIOS vendor. Yeah, you'll take an invalid address, and the hardware will say, I don't know what to do about that, let's reboot. And the BIOS will say, sure, sounds good to me, I get to advertise. Now, I have to say, in fairness to the BIOS vendors, as the displays have become more capable, the advertising has become more colorful. So that's good, because over a 20-year period, it's less boring. Okay. Now, at that point, this is kind of sad, right? Because this low mapping is something we're now going to use for about one instruction It actually is going to take two on this machine. We're going to turn on the mapping hardware, okay, and then, and I'll, you know, skip past the setup legacy map and setup PE map, at 362, we're actually manipulating the register that turns all this gunk on. And then if you turn the page to, I lost something. Hang on one sec. Okay, at 394, you will see that we move the address of drop low map to EDX. And for the first time, we do not subtract KDA. And the next instruction says jump to the address in that register. Why did we do that? Well, the not subtracting KVA is we're actually trying to get to the right address now. Why not just jump there? The answer is, well, this is a smart assembler. If it sees you jumping to the next instruction, it will say, oh, hey, you're jumping one byte. I know how to do that. I shouldn't do that with a jump instruction. I should do it with a branch instruction. The format of the branch instruction is jump to current address plus small offset, which will not have the effect of putting us in high memory. The reason we're going through this register is to hide from the assembler that we're doing this dirty deed dirt cheap. But if we make it as far as drop low legacy map, we're now running at the address we said we wanted to be at. Notice it only took us 400 lines of assembly code to get there, most of which are comments. It sort of really feels like a moment where everybody should take a deep breath, huh? Okay, something else I want to tell you about this. You'll see interspersed through here, you know, if have console write something to magic memory address. That magic memory address turns out to be the address of the screen, assuming that you have a video controller installed. And each of those writes puts two more characters on the screen, right? So, you know, call yo toss, right? And sorry about the pseudo-Japanese accent. And the more letters you get, the further you made it. Remember I said in a lot of the kernel, the best debugging tool you're going to have is printf? We aren't there yet. The best debugging tool we have here is infinite loops. The way you debug this code is you stick these kinds of magic prints into the assembly code, and you'll notice we're prepared to turn them off. And at some point it says, okay, good, you see the advertising, you know something's wrong. Where did it go wrong? I don't know. How can I find out? Well, I'll put in a sequence of instructions that just goes in an infinite loop, and I'll see how many characters that Kyoto's made it to the screen. If I make it to the infinite loop without rebooting, I haven't hit the problem yet. We're talking high-level debugging tools here. If you have an in-circuit emulator, you can do better than this. The irony is it's much harder to develop on a PC than it is to develop on an embedded board, because people developing on an embedded board rapidly shrug their shoulders and say, my time is worth a lot more than the $2,500 for the really good in-circuit emulator. I'll just buy one. And then they can single-step their way through this stuff. Okay. Now, good. We're actually going to make it out of this. Okay. The problem with this low-level memory map is we don't want it, because it's defining valid addresses that the applications are in due course going to own. So we really want to get rid of those, and this bit at drop low legacy map is basically doing just that. Though it occurs to me that it is doing it wrong. Oh, yes, drop low, no, it's not doing it wrong. So between drop low map and drop low legacy map, those are doing the two cases, depending on which model we're doing, of turning off the mappings at the low addresses. At this point, we have valid mapping, we have valid mappings, possibly to not present physically pages, from 3 gigabytes up. I think it was actually 3 gigabytes. It may have been less than that. I may have been more conservative. And now we got to set up the stack again, because the stack pointer is still pointing to that low address that we just took out. Now we're going to load the stack pointer at its real address, and at least for this CPU, that's going to be the stack pointer for the kernel for the rest of eternity. At this point, we're running, if we have a multiprocessor, we're running on what's known as the bootstrap processor, right? This is whatever, when a multiprocessor powers up in a Pentium system, processors all stare at each other, right, and they have a gunfight. The guy who loses gets to be the processor that runs the BIOS. Yeah. So, and at this point, assembly code being so transparent and debuggable, call C, which happens at 4:45. And the reason that we're calling kernel main rather than main is the ANSI C standard tells us that if we call it main, it has to return an integer and it has to accept a command line. Either of which, you know, we have no command line to give it, and if it were to return an integer, what the heck would we do with it? Okay, but at this point we're running C code. We will be momentarily. And at kernel main, the first thing that we're immediately going to do is turn around and call the architecture-specific initialization routine, which I will start in on next time, because we're at the end. Okay. I am not going to go through everything in this level of detail, but I wanted you to get a feel for how pleasant it is to get the processor to be your friend. And it's not that this is hard to do after you know how. It's that it's very sensitive to doing things in the wrong order or not quite the wrong way, and it's really obvious, easy code to debug. Past this point, we're going to continue to have that problem for a while, but past this point, usually that problem is going to turn into getting the machine not to reboot before we get a chance to read the printf output. Occasionally, it will reboot spontaneously? No. But in an unintended way, and then we'll have to go track it down the hard way. Right? And we'll do binary search. How do you do binary search? Well, you put a diagnostic in a certain place, and you see if you make it that far. If you made it that far, it wasn't in the first half. I'm not kidding. I mean, it's that sort of the level where this stuff, a lot of this stuff ends up getting debugged. But what we're then going to do in the just to sort of anticipate, what we're going to do in the architecture-specific initialization, some of which, by the way, is not being used, we're going to go find out how many, what kinds of things we're going to do. We're going to find out how many processors we have. This code base is not yet supporting multiple processors, so we're not going to do much with that information. Worse, some parts of the code are ready and some parts are not. So we're going to be inconsistent about what we do with that information, but since we're not going to use any of those data structures, it won't matter. We're going to find out where the memory was. All those steaming turds that Grub left us, we're going to figure out where they are, and we're going to use the pooper scooper on them. And we're going to copy that information into memory that we know where it is. And then we're going to say goodbye to Grub and move forward. We're going to poke the interrupt control system, because that's not been initialized. In fact, at the moment that Grub handed us control, interrupts were disabled. And we're in a race with the clock to decide whether we will enable interrupts or the watchdog timer will go off and the machine will reboot on the assumption that the processor has become non-responsive. So that's something we want to do early. And before we can do that, we have to tell a lot of pieces of hardware to shut up, because we're not ready to talk to them. There's a whole set of bootstrapping stuff that we're going to have to do, and then we will get into the kernel proper. Most of this stuff is not very exciting, except that it involves some idioms that I want to point out to you on the way through. So what I'd ask you to do for next time is actually look at the code samples I handed out first day. We're going to walk through a little more of them early next time, and then I'm going to start in on some more design issues. We're going to go back and forth in this way. Okay? Good. I will send you email. I have all your email addresses. If anybody did not get themselves on the list the first day, can you please make sure you get on the list now? I will send you email with some things to look at and also with some information about what to bring next time so that we have all of what we need. And I apologize for not doing that this week. As of Monday night, I'd had, I think, 12 hours sleep in 4 days. So sending that email slipped, and I apologize. So, thank you all again, and it will get easier from here, if only because the programming language will be less alien. I'm not sure that's true, but at least it will be one that we've seen before.